New year, same old song and dance. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Good to be back with you here in the studio. We haven't done one of these now for what?
Don't go there, okay? Yeah. Just don't go there. Yes, it has been holidays and polar vortex best of weeks here at the Principles and Policies program. But, you know, Chuck, I mean, we set out we were going to do some things over the holidays, but time and tide turning the way they do, we weren't able to get there and get that done. So, you know, we hope that everybody enjoyed hearing the best ofs to end out the year of 2013, even though that wasn't our original plan.
No. Well, we did run an original, although I thought I ran it a couple of times, and it turned out I was running something else.
Well, that's all right. Yeah, as you know, folks, this is not a professional program. We are purely amateurs, and we're doing the best we can. But anyhow, we're grateful to be back for 2014. It has been a fairly eventful year in 2013, although our recording archives may not show that with some of the best ofs we've had to run. But honestly, ladies and gentlemen, just like we said here at the opener, it's a new year, 2014. You know, optimism, hope, bright futures ahead. Or is it the same old song and dance that we've been getting for a while? And you know, Chuck, we're right now, we're about a little over a week into the new year, and other than a significant weather event that pretty much everybody in our listening audience were impacted by, nothing really much has changed, has it?
Maybe gotten a little worse.
Well,
it
only looks like it gets worse,
yeah, that's
Chuck,
true.
Because what happens is most of the time the mainstream media downplay how bad things really are until it gets away from them, and then they have to actually report on some of the things because they just can't avoid it anymore.
I would say no, it depends on if someone they like is in power or someone they don't like is in power.
I will give you that one.
Because essentially if it's someone they don't like in power, then every time somebody does something like accidentally trip somebody at church, you know, with their foot out in the aisle and somebody trips over it, was this deliberate? Was this person a person of color or a person of some kind of minority status?
Yeah, were they ethnically or in some other way a disadvantaged class?
Some disadvantaged class, and he tripped him on purpose in church. Or if it's someone they like in power, they will ignore things like allowing American ambassadors to be murdered inside the embassies while sending no help, and then run interference while the whole thing is covered up, and in fact print multi-part lies in newspapers, hello, New York Times, regarding what happened at that thing, that where the media... The opposition media comes out and says, well, now, wait a minute. If that happened, then why did this go on? That's the kind of thing you see. And because this is something that has come up recently for me, because of the quote-unquote guru status that New York Times holds, it's basically the paper of record. The old gray lady alongside the Washington Post,
right,
known around these circles as the Washington Compost. And the New York Times known as the New York Slimes. And there is good reason for that because, frankly, they run lies. And then even when they're caught in the lie, they come out and print a retraction, but that isn't really one.
Well, you know, if you can apologize without really apologizing
yes.
That's almost an art form in our culture these days, Charles.
Yeah. Simply a reflection of how the culture works these days. And it's a reflection, honestly, journalism isn't, the New York Times isn't any different than it was as far back as the 1930s when you had Walter Duranty writing stories in which he made stupid statements after he visited the Soviet Union. This was in the late 20s, saw Stalin's Russia in its really formative years and said, I've been to the future and it works.
and that's not to confuse Walter Duranty with Jimmy Duranty, who actually had some talent.
Yes. Walter Duranty was – and this, again, nothing new. The people that I was taught supposedly to lionize and to admire when I was a kid were these muckraking journalists.
Wait a minute. Were you homeschooled?
No, I was not. I was public school, baby.
Wait a minute. And you were taught to idolize and venerate liars.
Liars.
And people of questionable ethics.
Yes. People like Ida Tarbell, who wrote scathing articles excoriating Standard Oil. And believe me, there was plenty to excoriate about Standard Oil. But the fact is that she was an inveterate liar. And used the power of the pen to just create stories about Standard Oil. And it turns out that Ida Tarbell, her brother had some dealings with Standard Oil that didn't work out well for the brother. So she just basically picked up the pen to get revenge.
See, nowadays, if you do that online, companies now can come back and sue you for damaging their reputation.
Okay. That's
unless, of course, you have a byline in a newspaper.
That's one of the things that's coming in the future. There's a story on Yahoo several weeks ago about a lady who had ordered some goods for a gift from a company. The company took the money and never sent the goods.
Now, that's never happened to anybody in our listening audience, I'm sure.
That happened before. And so what she did was she went immediately to her credit card company and stopped the transaction. So no actual transaction happened. But she went on to a website that specializes in allowing complaints against companies. And she wrote a scathing review of this company who failed to send the goods.
Right.
All right. So what happened? She got a bill in the mail from the company that had failed to do their duty in their business contract. And what it basically said was, you owe this because when you signed up to receive goods from our company, you signed an agreement that said, because we were doing a business transaction, you couldn't do it as you could not make any disparaging remarks or make any negative comments about. And it was in
always read the fine.
Always
print.
Read the fine.
Always
print.
Read the fine print.
Now, I'm not an attorney, but you can ask an attorney, and they will probably tell you that is a kind of a caveat in a contract that would be declared null and void after you'd spent thousands of dollars in attorney's fees and court costs. You would get out of that. But the fact is that this company was essentially on a fishing expedition, hoping that this woman, in order to save her reputation or to save herself these expenses, would acquiesce and pay the money. Well, she went back to the company where she had made the original scathing remarks, company who took the complaints about the original company. And they wanted to charge her $2,000 to remove her comment. Folks, this is the kind of thing that we are beginning to...
That sounds like a confidence game.
Oh, absolutely. It's a confidence game on both ends of the spectrum.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Now, this is the kind of thing where you would think places like attorney generals in a state... I'm not talking about Federal Trade Commission or any of that stuff. I'm talking about an attorney general in a state saying, wait. Hold the phone here. I mean, all a consumer did was make a public complaint, make a purchase from a company who failed to complete the business transaction. Now, I have argued, and an attorney can tell me whether I'm right or wrong, but my argument is, since the credit card company refused to pay and return the woman's money, no transaction ever occurred, and therefore the contract that she supposedly signed is null and void.
Yeah, it's hard to say, and I'm not.
Neither
one of us are attorneys, nor do we play one on television.
That's right. We don't play one on TV. Wouldn't want to play one on TV. I have a reputation to protect, and I wouldn't even want to be seen as pretending to be an attorney on television. No, but this is the kind of thing we're beginning to see. And before we went on air, we were discussing here with the studio audience, my wife, who's working at her computer here in the studio. We were discussing about suddenly restaurants and things are beginning to charge for when you go through the drive-thru
for
extra condiments.
Well, and it's not because these greedy corporate bloodsuckers want every dime they can get out of everybody. Or, well, maybe it is. But really what's happening, Chuck, especially here in Ohio, is that with a new year, we had a couple of, shall we say, body blows to the corporate body politic. Number one, the implementation of the individual mandates, which then means the employer mandates of Obamacare, are kicking in. So people are having to go out and get this minimum level of insurance or go through their companies to find out whether or not their companies are going to. And with a company like McDonald's, regardless of whether it's a franchised outlet or if it's a corporate-owned outlet, they're going to probably be over the threshold for the number of employees so that they're going to have to provide coverage or face massive amounts of penalties. On the other side of the coin, here at the state level, not only did you have a number of different laws that kicked into place over the last year, but you had one that got passed a couple of years ago that its next iteration went into effect on January 1, and that was an increase in the state minimum wage. Now, minimum wage, folks, let's talk about this issue for a little bit. And I know that we're probably goring somebody's ox on this one, okay? But I really don't care.
Do we ever not gore someone's ox?
You know what? I'm unapologetic about this one. A minimum wage is a socialist idea.
Yes.
Absolutely controlled economic planning idea. That's the reason why the left always talks about the minimum wage and wanting to push the minimum wage higher. It's a way to control both the employee and the employer through economic blackmail.
Well, it's not even a blackmail. It's essentially a gun in the back. You will do this.
Okay, sure, sure.
You will do this. It looks pretty on paper.
Well, and it appeals to your emotions,
yes,
too, because most of us think minimum wage jobs, you know, kids in high school or in college flipping burgers at McDonald's. Well, nowadays we see, you know, elderly people doing that, and we see middle-aged people who can't find work anywhere else. But the problem with minimum wage isn't, oh, well, the corporations have to charge more money for things because they have to pay more to get employees or reduce their workforce. And that is one of the consequences, Chuck, because, you know, honestly, we've talked about this before on this program. A corporation's reason for being is to create not just the product, but a profit for their shareholders.
Profit is always the primary goal of any business.
That's right.
I can remember, just as an anecdote, as a side note, and you can kick me under the table if this goes too far afield. there used to be a show on MTV called The Real World.
Yes.
Which we always laughed about. It's like the nothing like reality world.
Yeah, it's the real world according to the entertainment.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the goals on one of the shows, and it's been years and years and years ago, was they were all the people living in the house were supposed to create a business. They were going to start a business.
Yes.
And they actually had a guy. They had a guy in the cast who was an entrepreneur type guy, you know, a 20-ish entrepreneur guy. He thought about business. He knew he basically had great ideas about how to start a business. They'd sit down and start talking about this, and it was amazing how many people in the room did not know what the purpose of a business was. Right. That is to make money. What they thought, they'd ask people, okay, what's the purpose of a business? Well, it's to provide a service to the community.
No, it's not.
It's not. That's what you look for. You look for a service that the community wants and is willing to pay for.
Well, see, that's a very good business, Charles, because if they can figure out how to provide a service or a product that there is a demand for, they will be very successful.
Exactly.
And they will make a profit. If they make something that nobody cares for, nobody wants, and nobody needs, they're not going to last very long, because not only will they not make a profit, they will not be able to pay their expenses, and therefore they will go bankrupt.
And the really good entrepreneurs create the want or the need.
Well, absolutely, by marketing.
By marketing,
that's
right.
Now, dialing us back around to what we're talking about here regarding minimum wage. You see, the big problem with minimum wage, besides the fact that it's a socialist concept, is that a corporation having that particular primary function as their reason for being, and that is to create profit, when a governmental entity comes in and says, you must take part of what you're making and give more of it to your employees, they're doing two things wrong here. Number one, they're disincentivizing profit. They're disincentivizing the reason for being. Number two, we don't live in a society where people are slaves. We don't, folks. I don't care how much you want to hear it, you want to say it. We don't live in a society where people are slaves. We have the freedom to negotiate contracts. And that's what employment is. It's a negotiated contract. I don't have to work for a company A if I don't like how they're the level they're paying me or the type of work I'm doing. Mm-hmm. But if part of my contract for employment said that I would be willing to work doing the type of job that they had for me to do with the type of hours that they said that needed to be done for the wage that they offered, and I said yes, and I signed that contract, Chuck, that's free market, and that's where it is. And if I don't like it, then I have a couple of options, one of which is to go to the management and discuss the terms of employment and appeal and hopefully change those terms, either change the job specifications and descriptions if it's something that, you know, let's say if I'm elderly and I can't lift a 60-pound box of case of eggs up onto the shelf in the cooler, okay, maybe we can work that out.
Yeah.
Or if I've been working very hard and putting in lots of hours and being there all the time for them, possibly it's time to talk about the potential of having a bump in the salary. But what happens is with minimum wage, government, a third-party entity that really only takes, never gives, comes in and makes that company change the terms of the contract. It forces them by color of law to pay people more money than they contracted to do, which, okay, yo, they tell them up front, so they've got plenty of time to do that, you know, ahead of time. Doesn't matter. You still have to calculate, okay, let's say I've got 300 employees, and when the minimum wage goes up for the entry-level employees, what does that do? Does the rest of the employees see the entry-level people getting this bump, whether it's 5%, 7%, 8%? And I forget, I think this last bump took it up over $8 an hour for the minimum wage. It was like at $7.70, $7.80 something, and now it's over like $8.14. And I may have those numbers wrong, but I'm having a problem with my computer and I can't get online to figure out where it is. But the key is, number one, company has to come up with that money from somewhere. They also have to come up not just with the wage, but they also have to come up with the taxes.
Yes.
That go along with that, their portion of it, their portion of if they pay a, you know, retirement program or a 401k, that portion goes in as well. Plus, all the other employees who are there doing jobs but who are now above the minimum wage, you know they're going to be dissatisfied, Chuck, because basically in their eyes, well, part of the company got a pay raise and we didn't. So it's employee dissatisfaction that also happens as well, because not everybody got a bump. Now, okay, would, if there were no regulation whatsoever, would companies try to take advantage of workers? Well, sure they would. It's human nature, and human nature is by in its own evil. It's not good.
No.
You had a point here.
This brings up a point that has developed as we've been talking about this. You think about it from this standpoint, though.
Sure.
That's a two-way street.
It is.
And let's put it this way. A high-end restaurant.
Right.
And you go in, and the wait staff is first rate.
Sure.
They're constantly around to make sure your drinks are okay, the food's cooked right, anything you might need. They're constantly checking back in. He remembers your name if you gave it to him.
Remembers what kind of stuff you like, what you regularly order. Yeah, exactly.
Now, you go into a lower end restaurant, and the owner doesn't really care. Doesn't want to pay the extra money he needs to hire those people who might be at the high end restaurant. Is he ever going to advance his business to become a high-end restaurant?
Probably not. But again, if his main motive, if the primary motive is making a profit, sooner or later he's going to come to the realization that in order to let's put it this way.
He saw my face.
Yeah, exactly. If he has any concept of what he's doing, he's going to make the calculation that says, if I want to step to the next level, I have to. It's the old Reagan doctrine, a rising tide raises all ships. I got to raise everybody's ship. Now, again, where's government in that?
Oh, it's not supposed to be any place.
Thank you. But that's what minimum wage does, is it inserts government telling a company, you must pay more, and to workers who may or may not be earning the money they're making already, you deserve more.
Yeah.
And that goes so totally against free market concepts. And it also goes against what happens if the employer, before the minimum wage hike kicked in, saw a couple of employees he really wanted to, you know, encourage to stay with the company because they're great.
Yes.
But now he's got to pay, let's say he's got eight entry-level employees and he finds two of them that really could be something, and the other six are kind of, meh, you know. He can't really encourage those two he could, but again, going against the first level of profit, it's an investment. When a company gives somebody a pay raise that's not already contracted, that is an investment in their own company. They want to encourage that person to stay with the company and continue to produce for the company because it is benefiting the company. But when government comes in and says, you got to give everybody X number of dollars pay raise an hour, what does that do? That disincentivizes them or prevents them in some cases, depending on the size of the company, from being able to reward the ones who are good.
There's a lot of other nuances here, too. For instance, what it essentially does is it makes it impossible for the low-end restaurant, who fills a niche.
Right.
A place where you can go have lunch, the service isn't that good, the food's okay, but it's cheap.
Greasy spoons are good,
Greasy
too.
Spoon. So you end up having to go up the street to, La Chic,
whatever. We know.
Le Chic Bouffe.
We got it. McCormick and Schmick's up at Easton.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you got to spend $28 on lunch. Well, you're not going to do that, so what are you going to do? You're probably going to bag lunch or bring leftovers. The Greasy Spoon goes out of business because, basically, he can no longer afford to pay those wages.
Right.
And because of that, all of a sudden, all the business has to go to move upscale to where people also can't afford to do that. So what eventually happens? You force everything up to the high end, and all the middle falls out, which means that all these jobs that people would have had in the middle and low end disappear.
And that's the other problem with minimum wage increases, Charles. It is an unemployment program.
Exactly. And
the people who think they're quote-unquote benefiting from minimum wage increases are the ones who get hit with the unemployment. Because companies are going to be looking at value. They're going to be looking at investment that they have into what we call now human resources. Personnel. Employees. Now, Charles, if I had the choice between keeping those six minimum wage employees, or saying, you know what, these two plus three or four more that I've had here for a while really can, they could step it up and take the place of those six. I'm going to basically take all that money I'm paying those six, put it in raises to the other six, and fire those six
people. Yes, exactly. Because not only are you, people tend to look at that as, you're just saving their salary. No,
you're not.
You're saving their unemployment benefits,
yes,
their workers' compensation costs.
Their sick leave, their vacation time, if those companies provide those things.
Their health care costs.
Their impacts upon the rest of your business when they call off or don't show up.
Exactly.
Again, the good employees, the ones that, if I'm the business owner and I'm seeing these two that I really want to move up out of the eight, it's probably because the other six are either just treading water, have an attitude that they don't want to be there and it's beneath them to work in my establishment, or they have a problem with being perennially late, calling off or just not showing up at all.
Yeah, and the two that are doing the work, you can say to yourself, they are the core of the business right now.
Exactly.
They need to make more money, and they're doing the lion's share of the work. Now, when you get into a place perhaps that might have a union that says, oh no, all workers are equal.
Well, a union, and again, I'm goring some oxes here.
Yeah.
Unions are also a socialist engine.
Sure,
okay? So if we want to talk truly Christian principles of liberty and free market, we've got to get over our fascination with minimum wages and unions. And we have to be able to start thinking in terms of the fact that, number one, business doesn't exist to give people jobs. It exists to make a profit and provide a service or a product. Giving people jobs happens to be an addition.
It's a byproduct.
It's a byproduct of it. But that means that jobs, and okay, people are turning off their radios on us, I know. But that's okay if they'll stick with us for a little bit. Jobs are not a right.
No.
Employment is not a right. It's an earned reward for your diligence, your character, your sense of duty, and your commitment. Okay? Because I'll tell you what, Chuck, there are a lot of jobs out there. We talk about the unemployment rate, and everybody's like moaning and groaning our high unemployment rate. Jobs are out there. It's that people either don't want those type of jobs because they don't feel that they're the level that they're accustomed to, and they can't, quote-unquote, make enough money in those jobs, or they just don't really want to. The incentive of government support is stronger than the incentive to work.
Yeah.
Now, there are a few places where it's because of miseducation or lack of education that people don't have the technical skills for other jobs that are available because they may be more technically oriented or better than entry-level type positions. But again, there's where government has created an issue as well.
And that's exactly the point I was just about to go to. Let's go back to our restaurant example with the low end. Where do entry-level people start? They can't start at Le Chic Bouff
up here at
the high end because he's not going to hire anybody but experienced personnel who are really know what they're doing and are really highly capable because and they're going to make more money as a result because, let's face it,
you reward if you
go
success.
Out, if you go out with the family and it costs you $100 and you know you leave an 18 or 20% tip, that person may have waited on you for an hour and they made their salary, which is usually a pittance,
right,
plus $20.
Yes.
If the bill was $100, they got $20, and you're not there. You're not the only table they're waiting on.
No. Usually in a decent restaurant, a server will have somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 8 tables that they are responsible for over a 5-hour shift.
Now, how does that person then get the experience they need? They normally start down here at Mom and Pop's Greasy Spoon, but Mom and Pop's Greasy Spoon has been run out of business. Due to the minimum wage law, they couldn't afford to pay entry-level people the amount of money that they had to pay to get them the experience. So where do they start? This is one of the problems that you create an unemployment cycle.
Yes, and significant barriers to entry in the marketplace.
Exactly. Significant barriers. I can tell you this. I'm not going to pay a kid to sweep out the shop over $8 an hour.
Exactly.
It's not going to happen. I'll do it myself because not only is it $8 an hour, but what if he cuts himself on a piece of glass? So I got to have workers' compensation.
Comp. That's right.
I've got to have unemployment benefits in case we go through a business downturn and I have to lay him off. Of course, usually it's part-time.
And you also have to retain an attorney in case of liability
claims.
Yeah,
you have to retain an attorney. You have to, and let's face it, if he goes to buy healthcare on one of the exchanges, one of the first things he's supposed to do is turn me in.
Yeah, his report, you're the employer,
because I didn't provide it.
Yes.
Yeah. So he turns me in, and then I get to pay a big fine. Okay, folks, this is when we started talking about what's going to come in the future. You watch, because what's going to happen is if the companies are going to stay in business, costs have to be covered by the increase in the cost of the goods that the companies are selling.
As you would say, Chuck, it's an almost absolute metaphysical certitude that the cost.
It is. It's a metaphysical certitude. You cannot avoid. And people are going to demand. You know, we went through the whole thing in the '70s with the wage and price controls. How well did that work, Barry? I'm old enough to remember it. You may not be.
Yeah, I was pretty young, but I remember hearing about it.
I was dealing with my first job right about the time that the wage and I was making next to nothing anyway. I think 90 cents an hour or something. that was pretty good pay. You know, for the entry level job that I was doing, because we're talking 1971,
sure,
maybe
there you go.
Around in there. I was about 14.
Okay.
So I was sweeping out places. You can't find that anymore. There's no kid that comes in after school and sweeps out, empties the trash. Everybody, all the regular employees do that now.
That's yes.
And the reason that happens is because, you know, and when I was a kid too, there were kids that lived near golf courses that would go out and offer themselves up for caddy services. They'd stand there and wait, and hey, Mister, you want a caddy? And I'll do it for, you know, $2, whatever. And somebody'd go, yeah, sure, I'll have somebody drag my clubs around for $2. You don't see that now. And in fact, you go to a golf course and you show up to try to be an independent caddy, you will find a boot print on your backside real fast. They don't want you anywhere near the property because you're a liability issue.
You're a liability issue now.
That is the wave of the future. We have closed kids out. Kids are not developing an entrepreneurial spirit because they can't do things like that. They can't come, you know, they may have a great idea for this or that or another thing. How are they going to get it through to anybody? They're not in an entry-level position in a job. This is one of the reasons why you see kids who are basically content to have their parents chauffeur them around until they're in college. Very often they're not getting driver's licenses because what's the point? You can't get a job anyway. And mom and dad will drive me around. One of my friends has a license. He'll drive us around. You're really losing that entrepreneurial spirit that basically made the United States of America what it is. And what's funny is where's that entrepreneurial spirit beginning to pop up? Places like China.
Yes.
Which are sort of suddenly, you know, has abandoned Marxism and picked up a sort of a form of fascism, if you will. But even that's sort of got a whole lot of free market flavor.
Yeah, it's like the pendulum starting to swing back. They went from communism back down to fascism. At some point, they might actually become capitalists.
And there are a lot of the Asian tiger type places are becoming more and more entrepreneurial, while we're becoming less and less so. We're becoming more and more socialist. It really is. You watch the changes that are going to happen this year. Now, I honestly predict that something funky that no one expects is going to happen with the whole Obamacare thing. I think the whole system is probably going to collapse here pretty quick. It has to. The whole inability to sign up thing was just a portent of things to come.
Now they've backed off on, you know, because January 1 was supposed to be the deadline for all the mandates, and now they're starting to back off it, and they've backed off the employer mandate. I think what they've realized is this is radioactive for the midterm elections.
Absolutely.
And that's the big killer because, okay, Obama's in his last term. And yes, I hear everybody saying, thank God.
Amen, yeah.
Amen and thank God.
But 3 years left.
And if he loses in the midterm elections, in other words, he weakens his – if the House of Representatives strengthens to the Republican side and he either loses completely or weakens the Democratic hold on the United States Senate, he's going to have a real bear of a time getting any of his agenda through the Congress in his last 2 years.
Well, what part of his – I mean, honestly, what's he gotten done besides Obamacare?
Well, nothing.
Nothing. Because he spent all his political capital getting that done, all of it. And he did that almost immediately upon his ascension to office. Basically, by when that thing passed, when in
It was April of 2010. That was when they voted on and passed Obamacare.
Yeah, okay. That used up all his political capital.
Pretty much. I mean, and then the midterms, That year really kind of showed it, because there was a strengthening of Republican, the Tea Party surge in the House. Senate didn't change much, because even though the Senate started the Obamacare bill, it was the House that ended up kind of taking all the heat on it. The Stupak amendment, things, you know, all of that was focused in the House.
Yeah, remember the Stupak
amendment? Yeah, I don't even want to go back on that. But, you know, the reason why I said that was because we're coming up upon the anniversary of Roe versus Wade later on this month in the March for Life. Yep. And there's a little piece I want to, before we close today, I want to talk about.
Oh, we got lots of time left.
I know. But when we get right back around to it, the House, midterm 2010, picked up some seats. Of course, didn't translate, because things had smoothed over and all the Obamacare mandates were delayed implementation until 13 and 14. So by the time we got to 2012 and the presidential reelection, he could run on other things. And, of course, the Republicans did what the Republicans usually do.
Yes.
They figured out a way to take the gun that they had pointed at their opponents and shoot their own foot with it by making Mitt Romney their standard bearer for president, who had instituted the precursor to Obamacare, Romneycare, in Massachusetts as governor.
The Republicans yield. Now, I want the folks out there with Polish, that have Polish organs, origins.
Origins, yes.
Polish organs, too, yeah. I want you to understand that we're playing on an old, ugly stereotype that really isn't true. I know lots of Polish people. They're plenty smart, and they're very savvy. But there's an old saying that they're wielding a Polish revolver. And if you've ever – my dad had one. It was a joke piece that you mounted put up on a thing, and people say Polish revolver. You hold it. It's like a 38, except the barrel's pointing back at the shooter. Yeah. The Republicans wield the Polish revolver. And I honestly predict right now they're about to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory in the 2014 midterms.
I believe that very well could be the case, Charles. They're setting up, and honestly, you know, here we are back again. It's January of 2014, and now we're having another fight over the budget. And they're already talking about hitting the debt ceiling once again and compromising. And Paul Ryan, who's supposedly the non-titular head of the Republicans' economic team, saying, well, we're not going to talk about cuts and spending. That's off the table. Hello?
folks. And that's because they drastically fear this government shutdown thing. Let me ask you a question, Barry. Who won that last battle?
The Dems did.
I think the Republicans did.
No, honestly, the Dems did, because they got – what they did was – they won the step that they needed in order to make this step.
Oh, they made everybody. Midterms. They made the Republicans give.
Not only did they make the Republicans give, Chuck, they've now set up the meme for the midterm elections. The Democrats are trying to keep everybody employed, trying to keep everybody, and we're trying to mitigate the potential negative impacts of Republican policies. Now they're going to be. You're going to hear this time and time again.
Okay,
right now. Republicans, just here recently, people are beating up on Rob Portman.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of reasons you could beat up on Rob Portman, okay? And we're not going to go there.
Can I hold him while they beat on him?
No. But the key problem is that he provided a key vote in the Senate on extending unemployment benefits. Think about that, Chuck.
Yeah.
Republicans were not extending unemployment benefits. The same thing will happen in the House. Now, should we have federally subsidized unemployment benefits? Probably not. As a free market guy and as a constitutional conservative, it rankles me to no end. As a purely political animal looking at this as being a bellwether year, if you can make it happen, don't be totally stupid and don't let your opponents set the terms of the debate.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's exactly what they did last year when they got the debt ceiling increase, when they got all of the quote-unquote shutdown, slowdown, slim down, whatever you want to call it.
And ended up getting them nothing.
Pushed back. And it ended up getting the Republicans, honestly, nothing.
Nothing. I agree with you on that. Now, where I was coming from was the idea that this was some kind of PR disaster.
Oh, no. The PR disaster is yet to happen.
I think so. Well, everybody, what always happens during the shutdown? And you and I have talked about this before. What happens during a government shutdown? We've seen a couple of these in our lifetime. What happens?
The free market actually works.
Yes. People find out how little they actually need government. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Unless you're worried about maybe some public monuments being vandalized or something. That doesn't bother me quite so much. Yeah, really? Okay, there weren't some federal rangers out there guarding, you know, the Lewis and Clark Monument or something, so somebody carved a new name in it, you know, that kind of thing. So what? Big deal. I really don't care about that. But this thing is, when I say Republicans are getting ready to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, many of you know might remember who Richard Lugar is.
Yeah, Dick Lugar, who was the Indiana Senator.
And he basically got tossed from office by a Tea Party candidate who was then assassinated by his own party.
Well, not literally. Politically.
When I say assassinated, I mean figuratively, politically, he was assassinated by his own party in conjunction with the media. Got together and decided that we couldn't possibly allow this true conservative to sit in the seat, and so he made some kind of a misstatement, and they grabbed onto this, and it had to do with abortion, and they grabbed onto this and beat him to death with it. Now, what does Dick Lugar do? He goes down into a race in Georgia, where there is a Tea Party candidate as Republican who looks like he's going to get the nomination versus a quote unquote conservative Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
And Lugar essentially pours money into the campaign of the Democrat.
The Democrat, of course.
Because she's the common sense candidate. This is what I mean, and this is what you're going to see in this upcoming midterm election. Because what's happening is groups like the Chambers of Commerce are coming out and saying, we've got to rid the Republican Party of these nasty conservatives. They're saying, we're the real conservatives because we believe in big government and, you know, subsidies for business. Basically, what the Chamber of Commerce is doing is investing in continuing their subsidized existence.
Yes.
They are the big business. You go into any town, it's the big businesses who are members of the Chamber of Commerce, and the Tea Party is the small business guys. So what you're basically seeing is big business versus small business, and of course the big business guys would like to run all the small business guys out of business. And what you see in a lot of cities is the big business guys get subsidies and tax breaks. The small business guys get higher taxes and basically worse regulation to the advantage of the big business guys. Because after all, they're bringing in all these employees because we can afford to cut their property taxes because they're bringing in all these employees who are bringing us city income tax.
Oh, yeah, of course. It's all about the taxes.
It's all about city taxes. And the fact is, that's why we've been in opposition to city income taxes. I have been my entire life. There's no reason why a city needs an income tax when they have a property tax that they can operate just fine from. Unless you want your local police department to have tanks and armored vehicles and computers that the cops are busy hacking on when they run into things, which has happened several times recently, not here in Westerville, but in other places. So what I predict is you're going to see an all-out war in the Republican Party about who's going to end up in control. And unfortunately, the Tea Party is going to lose because they don't have the money.
Well, they don't, unless, of course, they can build a convincing argument to encourage the big money people who like playing the margins. You know, and in the Republican politics, that's guys like the Koch brothers or some other big money guys who like mixing it up and seeing what kind of things that they can get out of it for themselves. But you know what? It really gets down to the fact that the Republican Party is most likely going to end up shooting themselves right in the foot again and going to have a significant problem holding their numbers in the midterm elections. Now, maybe they might pick up a small handful, but you got to remember, we haven't even started hearing yet, and you're going to hear about it probably after next month when the filings are all due
yes.
in various states because of May primaries, of people who are retiring, who are stepping away. You know, the last cycle, during the 10th cycle, there were a lot of Democrats who were retiring from office early. They saw the handwriting on the wall. They knew that they weren't going to be able to hold on, so they stepped out. And the question is, are we going to see many retirements here before this election, or is it going to be more of the, we're going to be fighting and spending lots and lots of money over seats that are held and contested versus open seats? Now, that's a big issue, especially for politicians. Now,
well, you know, Max Baucus, a Democrat from, I think, Montana.
Montana, yes.
He is going to be ambassador to China?
I don't remember.
China, I
yes.
think.
Well, and if I remember, I think the one you're talking about was that there was going to be a primary for that seat between a very conservative Tea Party type and the daughter of Dick Cheney, Liz Cheney.
That's Wyoming.
That's Wyoming. No, that's right.
And she pulled out.
She pulled out last week.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me, I want to make sure I get this in because it's important because I know the vast majority of our listeners are pro-life and believers, and many of them are, well, some of them, I should say at least, are probably planning on a little excursion here in the middle of January to go to Washington, D.C. for the annual March for Life. Well, Chuck, you know, personally, you know how I feel about this.
Yeah.
I'm pro-life to the core. You know, and I do it through lots
and
of
you,
service.
And
on,
you show it, yeah.
I try to show it. But the one thing that I've never been able to get my head or hands or heart around is the March for Life, because I don't see it being very effective. I see all of these good-intentioned pro-lifers spending money, whether it's, you know, cheap, you know, everybody climbing on a bus together and driving to D.C.,
yeah.
or going out and, you know, or driving out and spending gas money or flying out or staying in a hotel or whatever it might be to go and, you know, well, we're going to go show the elected officials in D.C. how strong the support is for life. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, they poll on a regular basis. They know where the support really is and they know how strong it is. The March for Life doesn't really change anything.
No.
And my concern is, and this is the reason, and I've done this before, Charles, and I'll do it again this year, even though I'm, you know, for the purposes of full disclosure, I will be in Washington, D.C. that week. But it's not for the march. It's for other clients talking with U.S. senators and congressmen. But the key point is that instead of spending that money going out to stand in the freezing cold, hearing a handful of speakers, and doing something that really is politically ineffectual and really gives the other side a chance to get out there and protest. And of course, who's the media going to?
It doesn't matter how many hundreds of thousands of people show up in D.C.
We create this massive PR event for the pro-aborts.
Yes,
That's exactly what happens. If people would stay home and give that money that they were going to spend on going to the March for Life to their local pregnancy care center or local adoption agency or local pro-life or group.
You notice we didn't say the Republican Party.
No, we will never say that.
No.
But the point, and that will bring me, thank you for pointing that out, 'cause that brings me to what I'm going to talk about next.
Good, because I know where you're going.
You know where I'm going. But the key is, if people would just write that check to their local pregnancy centers or their local adoption agency or even to the local church that might be helping with a baby clothes drive or whatever. Folks, we can end abortion not by going out and giving a free PR to our opponents, but by actually taking that money the D.C. hotel industry and the charter bus industry might
feel the pinch.
Feel a little pinch. But how much stronger would our pregnancy care centers be if the 80 or 100 people who from their community who are taking the bus to D.C. sat down and wrote them a $200 check?
Yeah.
In January. So they could go into the schools or meet women who are in crisis pregnancies and convince them not to abort their babies and work with them to either care for their own children or to adopt them out. How long do you think it would take, Chuck, before we would really see the tide turn and abortion as a quote-unquote sacred right in this country would come to an end? Honestly, I don't think it would take nearly the 40 years.
I was going to say, shorter than 40 years.
That we've been out marching in D.C.
and demanding the right, quote-unquote, right Supreme Court justices to make sure that we get Roe v. Wade overturned. folks.
And honestly, you want to have an impact on legislators. If they think you're coming and then nobody shows up, but you send a phone call or an email or a fax to them saying, "I'm putting my money where my mouth is. We're going to start investing locally on changing the environment for pro-life. We hope that you vote the right way. If not, we will use our money to change that environment as well."
Yeah.
If they realize you're extremely serious. Now, granted, I'm not knocking or trying to deride anybody who goes to the March for Life.
No.
Because they have pure purposes for it. The problem is, strategically thinking, it doesn't get you to where you need to be. But what it does do is that it gives demagogues the ability to pull the wool over your eyes. We started this whole hour talking about people who lie for a living.
Yes.
Newsflash coming from the Washington Times.
Yes.
As of yesterday, exclusive art from the Washington Times, Republicans set to deliver big statement on abortion. Really? I wonder what that big statement's going to be, Charles. I can almost guess. But then the byline, winter meeting of the Republican National Committee to be delayed so members can attend March for Life on the National Mall. Wow. Guess what, Chuck? Here it is, the Republican Party demagoguing something like this when they've spent so much time while they're in session running away from doing anything about abortion statutorily.
Oh, absolutely. Look at the Ohio legislature. These will be some of the guys who will be on big on board on this big move.
Yeah.
Who absolutely refuse to do anything on any serious pro-life legislation.
Including
the heartbeat bill in the Ohio legislature.
Right. Now, here's the blurb from the article, Chuck, and I think that the Washington Times inadvertently backed into the truth.
Well,
and I don't say that they lie for a living, but the point is, they inadvertently backed into a truth I don't believe that they were actually trying to put out there. In an unprecedented show of opposition to abortion, and folks, that's all it is. It's a show. That's what this is all
exactly.
about. Exactly. Our Republican National Committee Chairman, Rince Priebus, is delaying the start of the party's annual winter meeting. Okay, stop, Chuck. Think about it for a second logically. If they were so committed to being anti-abortion, why'd they schedule their winter meeting to start during the week of the March for Life that everybody's known about for 40 years?
Yes, we've been doing this since 1973.
It's on the same week every year, boys and girls. Same week every year, because it's the week that the decision came out on Roe v. Wade. If Rince Priebus is so pro-life and they're so committed to this, you would have thought that they could have scheduled their winter meetings for the week prior or the week after. Okay, but here we go, Chuck. He is delaying the start of the party's annual winter meeting so he and other committee members can join the March for Life on the Mall, the Washington Times has learned. Mr. Priebus, a plain-spoken Greek Orthodox lawyer, I think that's a contradiction in terms, isn't it?
Yeah.
Plain-spoken lawyer? Okay.
Yeah, and Greek Orthodox, unfortunately, folks.
From Wisconsin, will join members of his party's national committee and thousands of other abortion opponents, read, free labor for the general elections.
Yep.
In the annual Right to Life March scheduled for January 22nd, the anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision that declared abortion a constitutional right. Wrong. It did not clear it a constitutional right because there's no place in the Constitution
for it. There's no constitutional right for
it. And the courts cannot create constitutional rights. The only way a right is granted is by God, and the only way it can be secured is by appropriate legislation of the Congress, which the judiciary is not.
That's right.
Okay. So anyhow, I think they backed into it because really, Chuck, what this is a show. This is, even if I wanted to be charitable, which I'm really not feeling that way today, so ladies and gentlemen, just...
yes, the Christmas season has passed.
honesty's coming to the forefront here. Whether Rince Priebus personally is opposed to abortion or not, the party as a whole, other than writing it in their platform, doesn't really care because it's too big of an issue to settle. Because if you didn't have the abortion issue out there, you wouldn't have all those marchers.
Have any, yeah.
And if you didn't have all those marchers, you wouldn't have all that time to be able to talk to them about how they got to elect good Republicans whose party platform stands for pro-life so that they can win. Chuck, neither side want to see the abortion debate end. The Democrats use it for fundraising and to show a boogeyman to their supporters, and the Republicans use it for fundraising and to show a boogeyman to their supporters,
and
to hold out false hopes and promises that they will never legitimately cash in.
Let me read you something.
Please.
RNC for life.
Great.
Okay. The Republican Party has a century and a half tradition of standing for certain principles and for an identity different from other parties. This difference between the parties is essential to our process of self-government.
I can read that numerous ways already, but go ahead.
Yeah, now, basically, where I wanted to go with this is the Republican Party is the pro-life party. The Republican Party, that's the name of this piece. The Republican Party is the pro-life party.
Really?
Barry, that's the entire fight between, it's one of the big issues in the fight between the Tea Party.
And the Republicans.
And the establishment Republicans.
Yeah, it's not really so much over gun rights. It's over abortion, and it's over homosexual marriage. And it's over whether you centrally control the economy or you use free market principles.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are the arguments.
And in fact, the establishment Republicans are pro-abort. They're pro
homosexual marriage.
Homosexual marriage. They're pro gun control.
Yeah.
They're pro big business controlled economy.
They're what they call Main Street Republicans.
Yes. Folks, the Republican Party is not pro-life. Now, look, Barry and I have been involved in third-party politics. And one of the parties we were involved with claimed to be, at one point, they said 100% pro-life.
Yes, they did.
And we were thrown out of the party for actually demanding that the platform, which says it's 100% pro-life, be followed by state parties who wanted to run pro-abort candidates.
Right.
Okay. So it comes up. There's a party split. This third party, and what happens in the next election? Someone who I'm not going to bring up the name because it's kind of past the point where it really matters at this point.
It doesn't matter.
But this candidate, who's well known nationally, basically came out and said, "Well, we're the most pro-life party."
Right.
No longer were we 100% pro-life. We're the most pro-life party. As if there are degrees of that. Well, we're 90% pro-life.
Well, the center cannot hold, Chuck. That's the problem. When you get off of principle, you can't hold it. You cannot hold anything anymore, and then you just keep creeping farther and farther away from it. 150 years ago, the Republican Party maybe had been pro-life. I don't know.
It didn't. You know, that issue didn't even come up because, if you think about it, that was not really something that came to the forefront of anyone's thinking until the late 1920s or 1930s.
That's right. Yes, with the rise of progressivism and radical.
There have always been abortions. There have always been attempts at birth control. But there was never any concerted effort to be able to murder infants until Margaret Sanger.
And the eugenics movement.
And the eugenics
movement. That's right. That's right. And so we're reaping some of the bitter harvest of some of those seeds that were planted. But the key is, folks, don't be gullible. Rince Priebus and they did not delay the start of their meeting because it's so important to them. They scheduled their meeting so they could get this PR opportunity so that it would look like they were so committed to this issue that they didn't really care to start their meeting. They could start their meeting anytime, Charles. I mean, you know, honestly, they're all going to go to Florida somewhere or to the Bahamas and have their winter meeting somewhere where they can all have a nice vacation on the taxpayers' dime, probably. Uh-huh. And, okay, so now we get this nice little PR hit. Oh, look how important it is to us. We're delaying our business in order to show how pro-life we are.
Yeah.
Hey, I got an idea. How about you just have your elected officials who are members of the RNC stand up on the floor of Congress and say, we are going to filibuster everything that happens in this House until we repeal Roe v. Wade.
No bills pass until Roe v. Wade is gone.
Until it dies, period. Geez, do you think that maybe the media will beat them up. Do you think the Republican Party will actually gain support that way? Or do you think that they think they're going to gain more support by just going out there and saying a few nice words and showing the flag?
We're at the end of our time, but what this is plugging the hole in the boat. They know the hole in the boat is there with this whole split between the Tea Party and the the establishment Republicans. This is an attempt to plug the hole with pro-lifers. Don't get sucked in, because we've been sucked in by this rhetoric now for the last 40 years. Don't buy it. It's the same old story over and over and over.
Hey, with your time, effort, talents, and treasure, support local pregnancy care centers, support local groups that are teaching abstinence education in the schools, support organizations that are helping people to adopt children. That's where you should be, right? Support your local church. Those are the places where we should be spending our money, not going out to freeze our backsides off on the mall in D.C. to give politicians a free photo op.
And with that being said, join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.